Good evening. I'm William Brangham. Jeff Bennett and Amna Nawaz are away. On the NewsHour tonight, congressional leaders meet with President Biden but make little progress on a deal to raise the debt ceiling and avoid a catastrophic default. Then, the head of the company behind ChatGPT tells lawmakers that regulation is needed to keep rapidly developing artificial intelligence in check. And a new biography of Martin Luther King Jr. finds the civil rights leader was misquoted when asked what he thought of Malcolm X.
We've been telling the story of the relationship between Martin Luther King and Malcolm X for generations, based in part on that quote, the sense that Martin Luther King had this antagonism, and it just wasn't true.
Welcome to the NewsHour. President Biden is cutting short his upcoming trip to Asia to continue negotiations to avoid a historic default for the country. Pressure is mounting because the government could run out of money to pay its bills by June 1st if an agreement isn't struck by then. Biden announced the change to his schedule hours after meeting with congressional leaders on raising the debt limit.
I'm confident we're going to continue to make progress toward avoiding default and fulfilling America's responsibility as a leader on the world stage. However, I'm cutting my trip short. I'm postponing the Australia portion of the trip and my stop in Papua New Guinea in order to be back for the final negotiations with congressional leaders.
The House Republicans passed a bill that raised the debt ceiling, limited our future spending, saved taxpayers money by being able to pull back unspent money and waste, and actually grow our economy by making our economy stronger and helping lifting people out of poverty into work. And so those are the parameters we'll talk about.
That was House Speaker Kevin McCarthy speaking after their meeting with the president. Following these negotiations closely are our congressional reporter, Lisa Desjardins, and White House reporter, Laura Barrón López. Thank you both so much for being here. Laura, first to you. So the president cuts short his upcoming trip abroad, clearly seems to be feeling the pressure that he's got to deliver on these negotiations.
That's right, William. The president exited the meeting today saying that it was productive, but Treasury Department has stressed that that X date is June 1st, and it's just around the corner. Now, the president doesn't take the cutting short of this trip lightly. The White House stressed that the president really wants to reinvigorate the Quad. That's a partnership meeting that was supposed to take place in Australia that he'll be missing. That's between the United States, Australia, Japan, and India. And he'll also be missing what would have been the first ever trip by a president to Papua New Guinea, and the president wanted to focus there because of trying to pay more attention to the Pacific region.
So he's not going to make that part of the trip. What is it from your reporting that you understand is the White House's current position? What's on the table in these negotiations?
So exiting this meeting, the White House, be it the president or his senior staff, have said over and over again that the debt ceiling talks and the budget talks are on parallel tracks, but that they're separate. But we can report that we know a bit of the details about what's on the negotiating table when it comes to the budget. This is based off of what the president and Speaker McCarthy have publicly hinted, as well as what sources have told me and Lisa. And those details, what's on the table, are budget caps for at least 2 years, an ease in energy permitting processes, work requirements for certain government aid programs, as well as a return of some $30 billion in unused COVID money. And in addition to that, one change today, William, that a White House official confirmed to me is that there will be three new White House officials: Steve Ricchetti, counselor to the president, Shalonda Young, head of the Office of Management and Budget, as well as Louisa Terrell, who is the head of Legislative Affairs for the White House. They are going to be the three new leaders designated by the president to negotiate directly with Speaker McCarthy's team.
And Lisa, what is your understanding now about where the Republicans are after this meeting?
Republicans walked away quite happy tonight, William, because one thing they wanted, they got, which was direct talks with the Biden White House. No more negotiating with everyone else, including Senate Leader McConnell for the Republicans or Hakeem Jeffries from the House side, Democrats. This will be between the two major sources of power in this city, House Republicans and the White House. And there's something significant, too, about who House Republicans will be having negotiating on our behalf. One of their negotiators is Louisiana Republican Representative Garrett Graves. He's someone who was a longtime Hill staffer, importantly on the Energy and Commerce Committee. He's from Baton Rouge, William, and that's significant because one of the top issues for Garrett Graves, one of the things he's expert at, is that permitting reform that Laura just talked about. So, and we look at what issues are going to be more important going down potentially the home stretch here. Permitting reform, that could affect energy, drilling, environment. All of that, to me, I think, is rising very quickly now. House Republicans say they're unified, and they do see this as debt ceiling and budget talks together. And I think we're still going to face a stare down, but they're happy today that now, from their point of view, the real negotiations are starting.
And Lisa, one of the other things that Laura mentioned that Republicans seem to want is they want to add more work requirements to people who are receiving federal aid or assistance. Can you remind us the details of what they want there?
Let me take you through that. There are several different programs that could be affected here. Here is what House Republicans are proposing. First, they would like to take, they would like to apply all of this to able-bodied adults who have no dependents at all. Now, first, let's talk about the program our viewers know. SNAP used to be called food stamps. Republicans would like to extend work requirements to older group, 50 to 55-year-olds, in order to receive those food stamps. TANF, that is a program for families, the poorest of the poor. They want to tighten enforcement of that by the states and tighten the workforce requirements there. And then Medicaid. This is the most significant in a way. Medicaid right now does not have any work requirements. That is the health care program largely for the poor in America. Republicans would like 80 hours of work a month, and they would like that to apply to 18 to 55-year-olds. That is something that progressives have an outcry on, but Republicans say that they think this would save money, and they like the idea of, they think, getting more people to work.
And Laura, what is your sense? I mean, Lisa says that the progressives in the Democratic Party don't like those changes. What is your understanding of what the White House thinks about adding these requirements to aid?
That's right, William. Progressives have been squeezing the president on this one front, in particular on work requirements. And after the president felt a bit of pressure from those within his party, he publicly made clear that when it comes to work requirements, he's only open to those that cover cash assistance programs. He is not open to work requirements for SNAP, for food assistance, and he's not open to work requirements for Medicaid. So this is something that the president has felt a bit of pressure on from his left flank. But when it comes to moderate Democrats, they're relatively on board with this as a part of the larger piece of negotiations.
And Lisa, lastly to you, there's this looming calendar issue here. June 1st is this coming deadline. Do they have time to get this done?
Let's just take a look at how little time there is left. First of all, everyone knows today, May 16th, if you look at that on the calendar, here's the deadline, June 1st. That is the earliest that we could hit the debt ceiling, but it looks like it might be right around then. Here's why that 2 weeks is even less than people think. Look at that. Though that next week is when the Senate is supposed to be gone. The Senate needs a week, William, to pass any major legislation. They've got to get going now. I do think there is reason to believe the Senate will stick around next week for this. Garrett Graves, the man I mentioned earlier, he told me earlier today he thinks a deal can get done in 3 days' time if the talks are actually productive and even-handed. We'll watch, because that's basically about as much time as they have to get a real bill moving.
That is a very big if looming on the calendar. Lisa and Laura, so good to see you both. Thank you very much. In the day's other headlines, Russia fired a missile barrage at Ukraine's capital overnight. The Ukrainians said they shot down all 18 missiles, including six that were hypersonic. The Russians denied that claim. Mid-air explosions lit up the night sky over Kyiv. Ukraine said its Western-supplied air defenses blunted Russia's bid to terrorize the city.
It is clear that the capital has always been and is such a priority target for the enemy because there are essential state objects and important infrastructure objects. And there is a certain symbolism in this. It is clear that the enemy wants to strike at the very heart of the country and thus keep the entire Ukrainian nation in tension.
To the east, Ukraine claimed its troops have retaken territory on the outskirts of Bakhmut, where a savage battle has raged for months. But a spokeswoman conceded the Russians have made some gains inside the city. In Sudan, airstrikes and explosions escalated across Khartoum today as the army defended key bases from a paramilitary group. The fighting has intensified since peace talks began earlier this month. The worst of it is focused in Khartoum, but combat has also flared in the war-ravaged region of Darfur in western Sudan. Amnesty International is reporting a surge in official executions to the highest level in 5 years. The organization recorded 883 executions in 20 countries in 2022. That's up 53% from the year before. Iran led the list, carrying out 576 death sentences. Saudi Arabia had 196. Amnesty says it believes China executed thousands of people, but government secrecy makes an accurate count impossible. The European Union today formally adopted rules to regulate products that fuel deforestation. They include cattle, coffee, chocolate, and palm oil. Companies trading with the 27-nation bloc will now be asked to prove that their products have not led to a decrease in forested areas. Back in this country, U.S. bank executives were called to account over the salaries and bonuses they earned in the run-up to their own institutions collapsing. At a hearing, senators pressed the former heads of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. Maryland Democrat Chris Van Hollen challenged Silicon Valley's former CEO, Greg Becker.
Do you really think that getting a bonus of $1.5 million given the showing in 2022 and just a short time before the total collapse of the bank, do you believe you deserve that?
I believe the board did the best job they could in evaluating the performance that we had in 2022.
Well, this is why I think people watching this hearing are just going to be scratching their heads and get angrier and angrier, because this is clearly an example where bonus was not tied to performance.
Four senators on that committee have proposed legislation that would claw back executive pay within 5 years of a bank's failure. And on Wall Street, energy stocks sagged, helping to push the broader market lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 336 points, 1%, to close at 33,012. The NASDAQ fell 22 points, and the S&P 500 slipped 26. Still to come on the NewsHour, apprenticeship programs aim to alleviate teacher shortages. How fatherhood has changed talk show host Andy Cohen. The science behind why the Northern Lights are venturing further south this year, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Aside from debt ceiling negotiations, Capitol Hill was also focused today on what to do about artificial intelligence, the fast-evolving, remarkably powerful computer technologies that many believe could revolutionize and perhaps upend many aspects of our lives. The metaphors used to describe AI at a Senate hearing today reflected this spectrum. Some said this could be as momentous as the Industrial Revolution. Others warned it's akin to developing the atomic bomb.
We could be looking at one of the most significant technological innovations in human history.
Today, senators and experts weighed in on the gravity and growing risks of rapidly developing AI.
We have unprecedented opportunities here, but we are also facing a perfect storm.
Sam Altman is the CEO and founder of OpenAI, which is at the forefront of this new technology.
But as this technology advances, we understand that people are anxious about how it could change the way we live. We are too.
Artificial intelligence gained prominence when his company's product, ChatGPT, was launched in November. It can answer complex questions with human-like responses at startling speeds, but it also makes big mistakes. AI technology can also generate remarkably realistic images or audio known as deepfakes in an instant, like this one of Pope Francis sporting a coat he never wore. AI can also imitate people's speech, as Senator Richard Blumenthal demonstrated today.
And now for some introductory remarks.
Too often, we have seen what happens when technology outpaces regulation.
You might have thought that voice was mine and the words from me, but in fact, that voice was not mine.
In the hearing today, senators raised a series of concerns about this technology, among them how this example of voice mimicry could be used to spread disinformation.
What if it had provided an endorsement of Ukraine surrendering or Vladimir Putin's leadership?
Others raised concerns about everything from privacy to copyright protections to the potential elimination of people's jobs.
So loss of jobs, invasion of privacy, personal privacy, on a scale we've never before seen, manipulation of personal behavior, manipulation of personal opinions, and potentially the degradation of free elections in America. Did I miss anything?
So the question of the day, can AI be successfully regulated? Many agreed there should be some governmental body to establish global rules and norms, even issuing or revoking licenses to AI systems.
I would form a new agency that licenses any effort above a certain scale of capabilities and can take that license away and ensure compliance with safety standards.
But some lawmakers doubt they have the knowledge to even handle it.
The magnitude of the challenge you're giving us is substantial. I'm not sure that we respond quickly and with enough expertise to deal with it.
Gary Marcus, a leading voice in AI, emphasized the need for an international body, like those that regulate nuclear research.
Ultimately, we may need something like CERN, global, international, and neutral, but focused on AI safety rather than high-energy physics.
While he supports regulation, Altman warned that it should not stunt the benefits of this new technology.
I think it's important that any new approach, any new law, does not stop the innovation from happening with smaller companies, open source models, researchers that are doing work at a smaller scale. That's a wonderful part of this ecosystem and of America, and we don't want to slow that down.
And joining me now is one of those who testified before the Senate today. Gary Marcus is the co-author of Rebooting AI. Gary, thank you so much for being here. Before we get into the dangers of AI that you laid out before the Senate today, I know that you have said that you have loved AI since you were a little kid, and you see some remarkable potential for this technology, for humanity. Make that case for AI first.
Well, I love it as a cognitive scientist. I've studied how children learn language for a lot of my career, and it's just a fascinating intellectual question to solve it. But also, there's a potential, I think, to revolutionize science and medicine to help us solve things that we can't solve on our own. For example, molecular biology has tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of molecules in the body. No one human can understand that. AI might really revolutionize medicine. It might also help us with climate change. We might be able to build elder care robots that help us with the upcoming demographic inversion, where we have more elderly people than young people to take care of them. So there are lots of practical implications. And it's also just cool. It's just interesting for anybody who's, you know, grown up on science fiction books and written computer programs and so forth. So I've always been interested in it, and I would like to see it succeed.
So as you mentioned, science fiction often has pointed to some of the potential downsides of that, and you were warning about some of those today before the Senate. What are the other major concerns that you have about this technology?
I mean, it's actually a long list, and I keep thinking of Donald Rumsfeld's quote about unknown unknowns. We don't really know the scope of it, but just to start with, we know that democracy is threatened because we are likely to enter a regime where bad actors can use these tools to make essentially infinite amounts of misinformation at zero cost. That's incredibly plausible. And so we're going to enter an era where nobody trusts anything. That's obviously not good. We're going to enter an era where everybody denies any evidence presented them in court and says, well, that's just made up, even when it isn't. We're going to have chatbots that encourage people perhaps to commit suicide or do other terrible things, giving bad medical advice, psychiatric advice. We also have the potential for a lot of cybercrime. So these new tools can be used to manipulate people and to do so again at a scale we haven't seen before. And in the long term, we don't really know what would happen if machines got out of control and did things we don't want them to do. We're not really prepared for any of this.
Are there any current examples of AI doing some of these things that are the seeds for these future fears that you have?
NewsGuard has already just released a study showing like 40 or 50 different websites are generating their news automatically. We've already had things like CNET generate automatic news that turned out to be flawed. I guess those are the major first initial signs. We've already seen at least one case of a suicide that seems to be associated with a chatbot, where the chatbot, I don't even want to say on air, but gave bad advice and didn't refer somebody to a professional. So those are just some examples we've already seen, and we will see a lot more.
So there is not a great track record when it comes to the government regulating effectively technologies, but yet you were part of the group that was arguing today that we have to do something to try to marshal the governmental powers to get around this technology. What would you like to see done?
Well, in fact, I argued in my TED Talk and a few weeks ago in an invited column for The Economist that what we need here is an international AI agency that brings together scientists, government, and the companies to try to figure out what's best here, to try to align, to have global policy. There was pretty strong agreement in the room that that might be a good idea. And at least we need to do that at the national level. I don't think existing agencies are really up to the task of keeping up with the speed at which AI is evolving and coordinating with each other. I think we need some kind of central regulation around this. And there's lots of complicated political problems, but there was a strong bipartisan sense in the room that we do need to do something along these lines. One of the specifics that I called for in the room was that we should have something like an FDA procedure for large models that are deployed en masse. So if you had something that was used by 1,000 people, that's a research project, that's fine. But if you want to release something to 100 million people, then you should do a safety analysis, and there should be someone outside of your company that evaluates that and makes sure it's okay. And then after the fact, there should be additional monitoring as new issues come up.
Because we haven't really seen that thus far. What we have seen is basically the development of these tools and then their relatively quick release into broad use in the public.
That's right. The ChatGPT, I don't think anybody was really prepared that it would go out to where that 100 million people would subscribe. I think that took everybody in the field by surprise. The technology is not that different from what we saw a couple of years ago. And so none of us in the field realized how much the public would resonate. And there isn't really a culture now or a standard now about when is it okay to release it to everybody.
Isn't the horse already out of the barn in this regard? I mean, let's just say you come up with some global governance strategy here, and Google and Microsoft and the Americans and the Chinese developers and the Indian developers all get on board. Won't there always still be rogue actors who can use smaller versions of this technology to do all of the things that you are most worried about?
Some of the horses are out of the barn and some aren't. So we already, for example, have publicly available models that can be used to generate misinformation. I believe that we can build new technologies, but it's going to be hard to try to mitigate some of those risks. There are other technologies that haven't even been built yet, like self-improving machines or self-aware machines that maybe we don't want to build at all. And so I think this is kind of a dress rehearsal for even more sophisticated technologies than the ones that we have now, which are flawed and unreliable. And it's an opportunity to learn how to close at least some barn doors before all the horses have escaped.
You and several other people who have been studying this for a long time have been raising these warnings of late. Do you think we, as a society, are going to hear these warnings in time?
I was really heartened by what I heard today in the Senate. I saw a lot of bipartisan alignment and a lot of recognition that we hadn't really handled the internet right. I saw a lot of people with, I think, intellectual honesty and humility who were very much wanting to do the right thing here. So there's a long way to go from here, but I couldn't have been more satisfied with the meeting.
All right, Gary Marcus, host of the podcast Humans versus Machines, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
The first major biography of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in roughly 40 years is now out, and it has important new revelations about the civil rights leader and what he dealt with as a public activist and a private citizen. Jeff Bennett spoke recently with the author for our NewsHour bookshelf.
In his new biography, King: A Life, author Jonathan Eig sets out to present Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as more than a civil rights icon, but as a radical thinker with a rebellious side, and at the same time, paint a more human portrait. Jonathan Eig joins us now to discuss his research and what else we can expect in his new comprehensive biography of Dr. King. Jonathan Eig, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And you have written books about Muhammad Ali, Al Capone, Jackie Robinson, some of the most consequential figures in American life. In some ways, it makes sense that you would write a biography about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. But how did you know in the beginning that there would be anything new to say, anything new to add to the public's understanding of his life?
I began really simply. I knew that there were lots of people around who knew Dr. King, people who were still alive. I was interviewing some of them for my Muhammad Ali book, and I just figured my time would be really well spent traveling the country the next few years, interviewing people who knew Martin Luther King Jr., because the time was running short. And once I started doing that, I realized that there were also a lot of new archival documents that had come online since the last batch of books were written. It had been a good 30, 40 years since the last big King biographies were written. So I really hit the sweet spot. I had people who knew King still around, and I had a ton of new archival material, so I was off to the races.
How did Dr. King's upbringing affect his later activism?
You know, Martin Luther King Jr. was, of course, he was born Mike King. He was raised in the church, but not just in the church where religion was concerned, in the church where religion was seen as a tool to try to change society, that America needed to live up to the words in the Bible and the words in the Constitution, and preachers were leading that charge at a time when a lot of black people were afraid to speak out because they might lose their jobs. Black preachers had a level of independence, so King learned the Bible before he could read, and he learned the courage of black preachers before he ever went to school.
There's also the monumental revelation based on your research in the book that King's famous criticism of Malcolm X was just not true, that the interview that he gave Alex Haley, that Alex Haley misquoted his comments, and that forever changed the historical view of the relationship between Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. Tell us about that and how you discovered it.
This is one of the most shocking discoveries that I made. You know, as a routine when I'm writing a book, if someone does a good interview with my subject, I'll look for the original tapes of that interview. I'll look for the transcripts of the tapes, the notes, just to see if they left anything out. And I went to look for the Alex Haley interview. It's the longest interview ever published with Martin Luther King Jr. And the tapes were not available, but the transcripts were. And they were at Duke University's Rubenstein Library. And when I read through the transcripts, I was shocked, because the most famous criticism that Martin Luther King had of Malcolm X came from that interview in Playboy, when he said that Martin Luther King said that Malcolm's fiery demagogic oratory would bring nothing but grief, that his violence was doing nothing but harm to black people in America. King never said that. And the quotes had been changed dramatically. Some of them had been entirely invented. And we've been telling the story of the relationship between Martin Luther King and Malcolm X for generations, based in part on that quote, the sense that Martin Luther King had this antagonism. And it just wasn't true. What King said in that interview was that, I don't know that I have all the answers. I don't want to be so arrogant as to think that everything I say and do is right. I'm interested in what Malcolm has to say. I don't like his calls for violence. But they seem to agree on the call for black dignity, on the call for black equal rights. They agreed on much more than they disagreed on.
Do you have a sense of why Alex Haley would fabricate those comments?
Well, it's complicated. I think there was a sense of, you know, maybe he wanted to stir controversy. Maybe, you know, it was his editors pushing him. We don't know. But unfortunately, he played into the hands of those, including the FBI, who were trying to stoke controversy and a dissension between black leaders in America. There was a sense that if we could divide the important black leaders in America, we could keep them from really moving the masses toward the kind of society that they sought, with equality. And the people who were destined, who were intent on preserving the white power structure, wanted to see Malcolm and Martin Luther King not getting along.
You mentioned the FBI surveillance operation against Dr. King. There's some new information that you uncovered that you include in the book. How did that affect his relationship with President Johnson at the time, which was a critical moment in the civil rights movement?
This was one of the other really stunning revelations for me in my research for this book. I found the private papers that J. Edgar Hoover, the private memos that he was sending directly to President Johnson. These were not contained in President Johnson's regular archives. He asked his secretary to store them in a safe. So I found them in his secretary's papers. And what they showed was that Hoover was writing directly to the president, sometimes 3-4 times a week, with specific details, really sometimes very petty details about Martin Luther King Jr. And it really seems to have done great damage to the relationship. I think the relationship between Martin Luther King Jr. and President Johnson was the greatest single relationship between an activist and a president in our country's history. But that relationship was slowly undermined and really destroyed by J. Edgar Hoover's leaks, and I should say, by LBJ's complicity in that. Johnson was encouraging Hoover to keep it up.
How do you approach navigating the challenges of presenting a balanced and comprehensive portrayal of Dr. King's life, considering both his remarkable achievements and his personal flaws?
I think it's very important to be honest about our heroes. King was deeply flawed. He knew it. He talked about it in his sermons. He was not perfect, and I want to balance that so that readers of this book understand that our heroes don't have to be perfect. If we expect perfection, A, we have a very boring story on our hands, but B, we can't really hope to ever emulate the great men and women in our history because none of us are perfect. So I think readers are smart enough to see King, accept his flaws, wrestle with them as he did, but still appreciate his greatness and all that he accomplished and how he continues to inspire us.
You think so? I think we have so few heroes that there are so many people who are invested in the mythology.
Well, part of our problem is that people are afraid to step into roles of leadership today because they might be criticized for something in their background that might not be quite so honorable. And that discourages people from taking chances. You know, you have to take a chance to be a leader. Martin Luther King didn't look to be a leader. He wasn't asking to become the leader of the civil rights movement. He was thrust into it, and he had doubts about himself. You know, one of the things that's really painful, we have these FBI transcripts of his conversations. His phones were being tapped, his home phone, his office, his friends' phones were being tapped. And we can hear him in these phone calls basically pleading for understanding. Why is everybody treating me so badly? Why are the newspapers criticizing me so? Even his friends, when they say to him, you know, you should just stick to the voting rights in the South. You know, you're making too many enemies. You're costing us support by speaking out on Northern racism, by speaking out on the Vietnam War. King is begging them, don't you understand me? Don't you understand that this comes from my religious beliefs? I'm not a politician. I'm not trying to do what's best for my approval ratings. I'm trying to do what God commands us to do. And you feel his pain. So I think it's important that we accept and I think we can appreciate him more and respect him more when we accept his flaws.
Well, the book presents a vivid portrait of Dr. King. It is exceptional. Jonathan Eig, the book is King, A Life. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Apprenticeships are common in fields like welding and plumbing and carpentry, but until recently, the federal government didn't recognize teaching apprenticeships. The Biden administration changed that, and educators are now hoping that new federal funding, combined with experience from college programs, will open the floodgates to a new class of qualified, diverse teachers for America's schools. Stephanie Tsai reports from Dallas for our series, Rethinking College.
Correct, and then we see that they have some right ones.
22-year-old Priscilla Cano Padron says she's always dreamed of becoming a teacher.
I've always wanted to help people. I've always wanted to help someone in need. Just seeing the relationship I had with my teachers in elementary school and how they helped me, it's always been my dream.
She's a first-generation Mexican-American, just like many of the students in this classroom at Ardelia Creek Elementary in Dallas, Texas.
I see students that remind me of myself when I was in their third grade classroom. Cinco.
Now, thanks to a teaching apprenticeship, Cano Padron is on her way to realizing her dream. Teacher apprenticeships, at least those registered with the Department of Labor, are new, started last year by the Biden administration in response to the pandemic. 17 states now have registered apprenticeship programs, with interest spreading.
after COVID and losing so many teachers in our classrooms, we really had to come back to the table to figure out what new teaching models would look like. And we knew we had to do something different.
Sharifa Nadir Mason administers the program at Dallas College, which offers a low-cost bachelor's degree combined with paid on-the-job training.
Number one should have how many?
That's what Priscilla Cano-Padron was doing at Adelia Creek Elementary.
We don't simply want our students to be first-generation graduates. We want them to be first-generation unimpoverished. So we want them to walk into the field without the burden of student loan debt.
Well,
in nearly all 50 states, certified teachers are required to have at least a bachelor's degree, which comes with an average cost of over $35,000 per year. The student teaching in the last year is typically unpaid. It's a barrier for many would-be teachers. The Labor Department's approval of registered teacher apprenticeships unlocks federal funding to cover tuition, books, and fees.
That is a game changer and allows us to have a different conversation about who gets to become a teacher and how they get to become a teacher.
David Donaldson is founder of the National Center for Grow Your Own, a nonprofit working to expand the teaching workforce.
We help states and school districts across the country launch these registered apprenticeship programs with the ultimate goal of creating pathways for folks to become a teacher for free and get paid to do so.
Donaldson challenges the notion that teaching is no longer a desirable profession. He says there are teachers all around us.
Adela Creek, how can I help you?
Whether parents, tutors, okay, bus drivers, cafeteria workers, paraprofessionals, folks who have a heart for teaching, who if simply given the opportunity, and usually what this means is removing the financial barrier, would make an excellent teacher if given the chance.
I wanted to be a teacher, I just couldn't.
Ramia Dawes drove a school bus in Dallas for more than a decade.
I love driving the school bus. I drove the big old bus with about 50 kids in the back.
Getting a BA while feeding and clothing her two kids seemed impossible not so long ago.
I was working with kids for 11 years driving the school bus.
And that whole time you were thinking, I wouldn't mind being a teacher.
Yeah, I just didn't have the resources to do so.
The Dallas College Apprenticeship Program allowed her to continue her higher education.
It says, Karen brought 9 bags of marbles for a craft.
She made roughly $30,000 as a teacher apprentice in the Richardson Independent School District last year.
I'm working, I'm getting a paycheck every, 2 weeks, and I'm going to school. I've always wanted to be able to still provide for my family, but, also do something that I really had a passion for. Go ahead.
High minority, high poverty regions like Richardson ISD have been hit harder by the national teacher shortage. Tabitha Branham is the district superintendent.
If you would have told me 10 years ago that we would be a place in education where we start a year with anywhere between 50 and 100 vacancies, I wouldn't have believed you. But our surrounding districts, we are all faced with having to look at how we staff differently because the shortage is real.
The shortage is a key reason why Branham decided to partner with Dallas College. The apprentices help support the full-time teachers and also fill vital roles as substitutes.
It's an extra set of hands in the classroom. And then add to it, we've talked about the teacher shortage, let's talk about the substitute shortage. We have worked really hard to message to our educators, take care of yourself. If you're sick, stay home. So the fact that these apprentices are now substitutes for us one day a week, the relief of those teachers in that building who know that I might be off this week, but that apprentice is going to be in my classroom, they can really take the day off and not worry.
Through the Dallas College program, apprentices spend significantly more time working in classrooms than they would in a traditional program. Far better preparation for an aspiring educator, says Sharifa Nadir Mason.
We have a lot of smart people that graduate in education but haven't had the opportunity to practice enough. And so we built a program that is strictly built around practice.
The teacher apprentices are assigned to experienced mentors in the classroom, building their skills and confidence.
When I first came, I was like, I don't really know how to teach math, and I'm really scared. But I'm learning from people that are doing it in the classroom. They know how to handle classroom management. They know how to teach, and I'm able to look at it and model it.
18.
you have 42 little eyes looking at you. And with the help of Ms. Gaspar and all my other team members, they helped me overcome that shyness, that fear that I had of teaching up there. What do you guys see?
Grow Your Own's David Donaldson says the apprenticeships are the first step toward his ultimate vision, a free quality education for every teacher in America.
Imagine a world with no teacher vacancies. That is a really exciting thing to think about. Every kid having not only the teacher they need, but deserve.
A teacher, one might say, like Priscilla Cano Padron.
Okay, who can help me with number five?
She graduated this month and has already accepted an offer to teach fourth grade reading at a local elementary school.
19, 20.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai in Dallas.
Best known as a talk show host in the bright and shining face of Bravo TV, Andy Cohen is opening up in a new book about his latest adventure, life as the father of two kids. Amna Nawaz has that conversation.
Before he oversaw a reality TV empire, Andy Cohen grew up in St. Louis and worked as a producer at CBS News, later landing as a programming executive at Bravo TV, where he helped launch the popular Real Housewives franchise.
I don't have an issue with you. I never had an issue with
you. Yes, you have.
In its 17 years on the air, the brand stretched to more than 10 cities, reaching millions of fans. Cohen first stepped in front of the camera in 2009, hosting the late-night talk show Watch What Happens Live, known for its celebrity guests, boozy moments, and spilling secrets.
What is the hardest drug you've
His
ever
profile has only grown.
That just seems like an odd thing to say when
hosting the network's reunion specials, launching his own radio channel on Sirius XM, and writing a series of best-selling books. His latest, The Daddy Diaries, The Year I Grew Up, chronicles his day-to-day life and celebrity run-ins in the year he welcomed daughter Lucy to his family, joining his son Ben. We recently sat down to talk about family, work, and what made him want to write another book.
I love writing. It's my fifth book. It's my third installment of the Andy Cohen Diaries series, which was inspired by Andy Warhol's diaries, which I absolutely loved, which are very name-droppy. They're very celebrity heavy, and they're very much New York stories. And this is all that with the overlay of having two kids as a single dad.
Anyone who follows you online has seen your beautiful family, but tell us about your kids.
My kids are great. They are 4 and 1. The 4-year-old loves being an older brother. I was writing the book during, everyone says terrible twos, but it's really terrible threes.
Three's worse than two.
Terrible.
Three's like professional 2-year-old.
Exactly.
Yes.
Very, yes. Yeah. So, you know, we have some knockdown dragouts during the summer months of the Daddy Diaries.
But vacation's over, okay?
I know my way around a group of Real Housewives, which can be infuriating and exhausting. You can't get off the couch, okay? Is that a deal? So, you know what? I jumped right into toddler fits
Not that dissimilar.
Exactly. You just let it play out.
You write about the decision to have kids in the first place. You refer to this as the year that you grew up.
Yeah.
How are you different now?
Oh my gosh.
Before.
Starting in the happy way, I mean, I'm just a more grounded of a person. When you publish your diaries, you really look at what you do every day and say, okay, this is my life, or this is my life that I'm putting out there for consumption. And I got to the point where I thought, is this all there is? It's fun, everything's really fun, but I wanted to be grounded.
You've also said your book is a bit of a statement on sort of pop culture in the year 2022 and how much things have changed. There's one line in the book where you say, housewives often are offensive on some level, but the line has moved over 16 years. How has it moved?
Well, I mean, producing a show about a group of politically incorrect, outspoken women.
That's my opinion!
In 2023, in the age of cancel culture and people being offended by things you didn't know you could be offended by, is a challenge. And so it's changed a lot.
Just the brand itself, which is now very much an empire, it's changed so much since the first season. They were living in townhouses. They weren't their own celebrity brands. Now they're full glam. You have a huge convention with thousands of people. They are their own celebrities because of the show.
Yes.
Why do you think we have this fascination with this kind of television?
I think it is the modern soap opera. It is the soap opera of our time.
Everybody will know. I know that people who don't watch it, it's
very easy to look at the clips and have a judgment. But I think that the reason it's still on the air is that it's about friendship and motherhood and being a wife and a sister and family and a whole lot more. And there are things that ground it in relatability. It's also sometimes very aspirational. If it was just a drink toss or an offensive comment, it would not still be on the air, I promise. Like, there's no way.
Would you let your kids watch the show one day?
Eventually, absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
Would you ever let them star in their own reality show?
I would prefer that they not. And by the way, people always say to me, would you ever star on a reality show?
Yeah.
This is as close as I would get. This is a year in my life, but I'm in control of the edit.
Did you edit yourself a lot in this?
I edited myself, but I also pushed myself. Yeah. This is my fifth book, and I know, and I learned in my first book, you have to push yourself. This is the most vulnerable I've ever been in a book.
I gotta ask this too, because you, in the reunions you host with these housewives and your own show on Watch What Happens Live, you are a very skilled interviewer.
Thank you.
Because you know how to get people to share things that they probably wouldn't share otherwise.
Yes.
What makes a good interview for you? How do you do that?
So I was a producer at CBS News, so I not only learned how to produce an interview, but I learned how much time 4.5 minutes of TV time is when they're telling me in my ear. That's actually a lot of time to get something out of someone. Mm-hmm. So that was important training for me. But also, I think a genuine curiosity is important.
It does give you a platform to talk about other things that you really care about, too. You talk about LGBTQ rights. You talk about politics.
This is one big dog whistle.
Do you feel that's just something you want to do, or do you feel like that's a responsibility right now?
Well, as a gay American and as a Jewish American, two groups really under fire right now. Yeah. I feel like if there are issues facing my community, I speak up about it. Never did I think that people would be fighting drag queens.
Why do you think we're seeing that right now?
Well, I think it's a distraction from what's really going on, and it's a way to fire up your base. Let's hate on the trans community and drag queens, two marginalized groups of people. And I'm sorry, but the biggest issue facing the world is not whether drag queens are performing. It's not an issue.
You've talked about the heaviness, too, that comes with being a single father.
Yes.
To two. What do you mean by that?
I think that's why I called it the year I grew up. I'm a happy-go-lucky guy.
Yeah.
But my resting mood when I wake up is happiness. The weight of being a single father really hit me this year. I had been for 3 years before Lucy came. Now suddenly there are two. I just want to be everything to them.
You did say, I always felt light as a feather. This year my feet feel firmly planted. I like how that feels. It sounds like you're in a good place.
Yes.
Are you ready for a third kid?
No. Oh my God, you're going to scare me out of PBS NewsHour. Are you kidding me? You are joking, right?
we can talk about it later.
I'm dancing as fast as I can.
Andy Cohen, author of The Daddy Diaries, The Year I Grew Up. Absolute pleasure. Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much. Have fun.
You can hear more from Andy Cohen online with Amna's lightning round of questions, from his dream guest to his favorite president. That's on our Instagram page. Parts of the United States have recently been getting glimpses of the Northern Lights. John Yang spoke with our science correspondent, Miles O'Brien, for a brief explanation of why this spectacle in the skies is now being seen further south.
Miles, every year there's the Northern Lights, the Aurora Borealis, but it's usually restricted to the northernmost areas of the Earth. Now it's coming as far south as the United States. Why is that happening?
So the sun has a cycle, John, of about 11 years. It goes from solar minimum to solar maximum. We're right at about at the maximum, or we're approaching it. And what that means is that the activity on the sun greatly increases. And it blows particles from the sun in our direction that interact with the magnetic field in our atmosphere. And in so doing, excite them and make them colorful, in some cases green and red colors. And because we're at this point in time where there's more of this activity headed in our way, we're seeing wonderful aurora borealis or northern lights. And it is extending a little farther to lower latitudes. So it's a great opportunity. If you've never had the chance to see them, by all means, make an effort to do it. You don't have to go to the Arctic or to Iceland anymore because of this solar maximum. And, you know, what's great about it, too, is when you go to see them, every time you see them, it's different. It's a different kind of ethereal thing of green and red lights in the night. And it's kind of a romantic thing, actually.
Give some advice to people who want to see it. Obviously, they have to get away from the cities. You want someplace that's really dark. Where do you look in the sky?
When it's there, it's everywhere. Try to get as far north as you can. Like I say, it's coming down into the northern parts of Europe and in places where you wouldn't normally see it in the United States as well. The thing is to just get up in the middle of the night and wait and enjoy the spectacle.
And how long is this greater activity going to go on?
Well, I think solar maximum is going to peak out in about 2025, and so that it'll start scaling back. So in that period of time, this will continue to be quite a light show. It also has the potential to really cause some difficulties for communication satellites and the power grid. So we should be on guard for that as well. The sun is a big player in our solar system, to be sure. And when this solar maximum occurs, it's not just a spectacle, it's a potential harm to some of our systems. So we have to watch out for that.
Remember, there is plenty more online, including a look at why more than 500,000 Americans are on wait lists for disability services and what some states are doing to clear those backlogs. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm William Brangham. Join us here tomorrow evening when Judy Woodruff reports from her birthplace of Tulsa, Oklahoma, about the reckoning that city is having about its fraught history with race. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. We'll see you soon.